Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Bo Spearham with Let's Talk.
Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk. Before I go on any further, I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners on this land we are broadcasting from. I also would like to acknowledge our elders and also our elders of more recent arrival. And a big shout out to everybody that is tuning in around the country via the National Indigenous Radio Service. I hope everybody's having a great morning. It's been good for me. It wasn't too cold. It's starting to warm up again, which is good. But, you know, they say, you know, like us fellas in the Sunshine State shouldn't complain too much about the weather, especially the mob from down south. Whenever I have somebody on the radio from Melbourne, from Victoria, and I say, oh, you know, it's been chilly. And they're like, no, it hasn't. Down here gets the, you know, almost zero or, you know, below zero. And I was like, oh, you know, that's cold. But, you know, it's been good. And in the studio with me this morning, I have two deadly strong First Nations women, Tina and also Judy. And they're here for a national exhibition called Defining Empire. I'll just read a bit of the bio. Identity, racism, displacement, country, nuclear testing, sovereignty, and the stolen generation are among the important issues explored in this survey of contemporary Aboriginal and Torres Strait art, opening the 28th of July at the University of Queensland Art Museum. Touring nationally, touring from the National Gallery of Australia, Defining Empire, its third National Indigenous Art brings together 30 established, mid-career and emerging Indigenous artists from across the nation. I think that's one of the most exciting things is that, you know, it's an array of different type of artists with different types of experience that are coming, you know, that are being a part of this this exhibition, which is awesome. And I have the curator and one of the artists in the studio with me this morning. Just before we start, could I get the both of you to tell us your name, your mob, and where you're from?
My name's Judy Watson. My mob is from Northwest Queensland, one year language, many living in Mount Isa, and a shout out to them.
Deadly, deadly.
Wonderful. Tina Baum. I'm originally from Darwin, but of course work down in Canberra. But I'm the Larrakia, Wadaman and Gurradjuri people from the Northern Territory and Western Australia. And thank you both for having me here on your fabulous Queensland country.
Judy lives here in Brisbane. You used to live here.
I used to live here in the early 90s.
Yep. And you were working down at the museum?
Yeah, I worked down at the Queensland Museum. I was one of the early Aboriginal workers at the museum. Then actually I was the only one at that time. Mm-hmm. And it was absolutely an honour to work there and to really open up the museum to so many Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities in Queensland, because that's where your key collections are held.
Definitely, definitely. And I guess, Judy as well, tell us a bit, or we'll get both of you, tell us a bit about yourselves. Before we get into the exhibition, you know, we'd like to let our listeners know who we're talking to, paint a picture for them of, you know, I guess who you are and how you sort of got into, you know, being artists and I guess the art industry.
Well, I actually grew up in Acacia Ridge. I was born in Mundubbera and we came down to Brisbane. My dad was in the post office, but my brother's deaf, so he'd go to the deaf school in Brisbane. So that's how we ended up down here. And my mother's Joyce Watson. She's worked on a lot of projects around Queensland and Australia with Aboriginal communities, including doing the maquette for the goanna, which some people call the lizard, in down in Russell, West End. She's done a whole lot of stuff with ICT as well. When I left school, I went up to Toowoomba to study there at what was then DDIAE, now University of Southern Queensland. Came back and worked in a factory in Salisbury, saving up to then go to Tassie and study more. And then went up to Townsville and was there for about 6 years teaching at the TAFE College. Travelled around, lived in Darwin for a number of years, lived in Sydney, and other places, and now I'm back in Brisbane since 2003.
Yeah, I grew up in Case Ridge, and I was, like me and my partner and daughter, we moved back there early this year. So how long has that lizard been, the goanna been down there?
I was away, I reckon it's about 95 or something like that, I think they worked on it. Yeah, I've got photos of, like, my grandmother, Grace Isaacson from Mount Isa, who came down when it was just built. So, yeah, I reckon...
What was there before it? Was just more trees?
I'm not sure what was there. You'd have to ask Mum.
Yeah. And Tina, yourself?
Well, as mentioned, originally from Darwin, and really I ventured into museum studies, I suppose you could say, by accident. They had an open day at the Museum and Art Gallery of the NT there when I was in high school, and I'd seen all these stuffed animals, stuffed birds, and I thought, oh, that's fantastic, I want to be a taxidermist. and I discovered that, you know, you can do museum studies down south. So I started my studies at University of Canberra in 1988. So that was a big year for this country, of course.
Yes.
And so it was an absolute eye-opener for this young, you know, girl from Darwin, and really exposed to so much more history of this country that, you know, as a young person I hadn't really, you know, heard about. We're so isolated up there in Darwin. But, you know, then after graduating from the studies there, my first job out was at the Queensland Museum, which was absolutely fantastic and, you know, really opened my eyes on how we really need to, you know, look after and run, you know, be the major voice for our communities in museums and galleries. So Queensland Museum, then I went to back home to Darwin to the Museum and Art Gallery of the NT. Thought I was homesick, but not really. But then went down to the National Museum of Australia when that new institution was built. It's a, you know, once-in-a-lifetime opportunity there to get more of our voices into museums. And, of course, now I've been at the National Gallery of Australia in Canberra for 13-odd years now. So it's been great.
Are you an artist as well, or mainly just like a curator, just telling the stories?
I'll say just a curator. I mean, you know, we always so many of us are so creative on the sides and that, and I suppose my creative outlet is through the artists, through their works and being able to tell their stories. So,
and it must be a bit daunting as well, sort of going into, you know, these institutions, these museums all around the country when, you know, when they hold so much of our stuff and, you know, it's from a period of time that wasn't, you know, the best, still isn't the best for our people as well. You know, they have, you know, like the archive stuff that's, you know, not shown as well. So that must be pretty tough in itself as well, like...
Certainly in the beginning it was, but now after dealing with so many wonderful, strong individuals and communities and elders, it really empowers you to get in there and to really make a change. You know, so many institutions are run by white people that have regulated our lives since day dot, and you know, it's time to change. So we're trying to make a change by getting more of our people into museums and galleries, and really making a change from the inside, and really presenting our voices in a truer way.
And, like, I guess for our listeners as well, and like what I meant by, you know, it could be pretty daunting is, you know, we're coming across, you know, or like you'll come across bones, remains, whether they're from massacres or, you know, whether, you know, museum mob or, you know, white people back and they just dug them up and, you know, put them in here, artifacts, all different types of things,
Well, when it comes to, you know, repatriation of ancestors, my motto, and when I worked at the Queensland Museum, I'd always go into the areas where they were and, you know, sing out, you know, welcome them and say, hello, I'm here. I'm here to look after you until we can return you and do the best that we can for you, you know, and that's all you can do until you actually get the remains back to communities. And to prepare the communities too, that to make sure that they're ready to receive their ancestors back, because often, as you mentioned, they were removed under horrible circumstances without permission, and there's no need to collect ancestors. So, you know, it really, really strengthens you working in places like this. It, you know, it can be sad at times, but it really makes you strong when you think, no, you know what, we can make a change. We can empower our communities today, and we can look after our ancestors, even the material culture and our you know, the material that's in the collections as well, you know, still look after them until communities know about them, or, you know, whether they're managed or whether they're returned. You know, it's good that we have our people in there, you know, just caring for the power and the spirit of the ancestors and the works.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And Judy, yourself, like, how did you sort of get in to art? Because in the introduction you were saying you were teaching at TAFE up in Townsville. And
Yeah, so I was teaching in art. And I was going to say, just for all the young ones out there too, I was always interested in art and English. And when we had to fill out the QTAC form on that day, I suddenly heard about this course up in Toowoomba where you could study art and English. And also my dad was of that generation where he thought you had to get a real job, and so he made all of us girls do commercial studies, which is not my forte. In a way, it's good to know, because as an artist, you are an industry, you are a business. But I just found that that was really got me in. I thought, oh, I can be an art and English teacher. I went up there, really got pulled into art, but also literature. We were studying Australian literature, American literature, all of these other things. And it was the American literature, looking at Black, Jewish, Native American literature. I suddenly thought, I want to know more about my mob, my family. And that is what started me looking at that history. And that's what keeps me going today, is often words. So I get drawn into words, into stories, research, all things I find on the ground, or what's hidden under the ground.
And Tina, you mentioned you started studying in 1988 down in Canberra at the New Museum, and you said, you know, like that was a very, very, you know, that year in particular, you know, was a very politically charged year. What was it like being back, I guess, first working in museums like that in regards to some of the stuff that they held or vows? You know, like, you know, like we're fortunate enough now that there's more, I guess, representation with, you know, artifacts and stuff in museums nowadays. What was it like back then? And also, I guess, you know, it was bicentennial that year. Biggest mob in Sydney protesting as well. What was it like back then for you?
I think it was an incredible time where not only were, you know, as an individual, I was asking a lot more questions like, well, how were these, you know, material collected, why was it collected, blah, blah, blah. Talking about, you know, questioning the institution about it, but it was a fantastic opportunity to then collect our stories of that day and to today. So, you know, it was, they'd never had protest material before. It's like, well, okay, this is what's happening today. This is why the bicentenary is not for everybody. And to make people understand that, you know, 1988 was a big year for this country, but for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, it was bigger in a different way. And to understand why and how we as a nation came to, you know, the bicentenary, and at, you know, at what expense of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people were, you know, that this nation was so-called celebrating, you know, its greatness when it didn't have a great history. So we had an opportunity to present the other, our voice, the stronger First Nations voice in institutions, and it, you know, it rattled some people, and that's okay, because it's going to keep rattling as long as we need to get the real histories there.
And that's the important, I guess, you know, like that's one of the important aspects of art as well, is it that it rattles people to the core. You know, I guess, is that sort of with, you know, the name of this new exhibition, which is Defining Empire, and also, is that, obviously that's what it wants to do? And was that something that you always want to do when you set out to do your art as well, Judy?
Yeah, I often say that artists should be rattling the bones of the museum in terms of, like, what Tina was, you know, saying, calling out to ancestors, but also calling out to everyone, saying, well, we're here now and we want to find out, yeah, how the material got there. Was it exchanged? Was it bought? Was it stolen? Was it traded? And really look at those histories and make connections. And I also, I mean, I've done residencies along with other artists at the British Museum and other places. And the question comes up, you know, why isn't this material being given back? And somebody came up to me after one of the talks and said, well, if the British Museum is not going to give it back, why don't they pay the rent? And Gay Sculthorpe, and I said, exactly, that's a really cool idea, because if they're not going to give it back, they should sort of actually do this thing where you imagine a cultural exchange or a network going back to those communities where materials came from, and then if there was even a trickle of money going back from all the, you know, you imagine how much those museums make with visitors through the door, going back to a community, that money could then feed into the making of new objects and things like that, and maybe people from that community coming over and seeing the old objects, working with them. And there you go, you've got like a spider web network of objects and people going back and forth, and that creates a living history and a living relationship with the museum. So I think that museums are not dead, they just need to be shaken up. I talk about them being like a walk-in wardrobe with dusty old objects, and we just need to enliven them. And, you know, I do think that that sort of energy can spark and can, you know, ricochet across, you know, the walls and the floors of the building when the artists and the objects and people from that area get together.
Mm. Did you want to add anything to that? Or?
Oh, absolutely. I thought it was a wonderful idea that it's, you know, it's like a walk-in wardrobe. It's like, yeah, but we're choosing the fashion for this year, and we're choosing the stories and the makeup of what goes in there. And it's so true. It's so empowering when you can have that voice. And, you know, you can just imagine just the empowerment that would happen back in community when they could get access their, you know, the old material, you know, and you know, just reconnect with it. It's just incredible. So whenever you go over, like you said, with the British Museum, when you go there and you, particularly if you meet, meet with material culture from your own communities, it's such an emotional experience. You know, you're probably the only Aboriginal person from your community that has seen that been in connection with that work for over 100 odd years, and it's really sad that they're so far away. And so, I mean, I think that's why I like to travel a lot to the UK and England, is to try and go back and reconnect not only with my community's materials, but with so many others, and just talk to them and say it's okay, you know, we're getting there. We'll one day, you know, hopefully get that material back.
And it's good for the museums because you have this discussion and you have people being able to say, I know when I went to something years ago and I just happened to go in and say, oh, that's Spinifex resin. And they said, well, what's that? They didn't know what that was. So it's a bit of knowledge that you might have gleaned you can pass on. But even seeing Henrietta Fourmile coming through the British Museum where we were there, and she saw this beautiful sort of shell object, you know, which was sort of very similar, and she brought a photograph over of her ancestor, great-great-grandfather, Dingy, I've forgotten his name, but showing him wearing this very, very similar one. And it was so emotional and so incredible for everyone there to see that and reconnect. You could see the photograph of this man wearing this beautiful cultural, you know, sort of material object, and then you see the actual object and there they are, and suddenly it's like they snap back together again, and it's really emotionally charged in that space, and everybody gets it. You know, you can sort of see that then that cultural understanding is making its way and transmitting from the object, and I reckon they're speaking out to us, to all the people who are working with it and handling it. And I always think it must be like a little bit of osmosis, but also, you know, data transference between those objects and everything else that they're sitting next to in museums too. Because sometimes they've been away from their country for longer than they have been at home, and yet their energy's still there. And so that's why I made a work called The Holes in the Land, which talks about that fact that when something is taken, it leaves a depression, and yet the energy reverberates within that space, and the object still has it. So when it can come back and sit back into like the cupping of hands, it will reconnect.
I was going to cut to a song break. I will in a minute, but I just wanted to ask, any freaky like sort of stories and moments being in like those museums and looking at these objects as well?
There have been for me here at the Queensland Museum, but I've never been afraid. I've always just said, oh, you know, well, that, you know, I'm here, I make, you know, and it's not been necessarily good feeling, but, you know, it's just like, look, you know, I'm here to look after you, and, you know, you do get those feelings, but it's a very powerful energy, I suppose, that you can feel, and you just think, okay, I'm going to be very aware of what's going on here, and but just you know, never feeling uncomfortable at all, but just, you know, just always just felt honoured to be able to to look after the material culture or the ancestors whilst at in museum. So, you know, I've never ever felt threatened. It's just always just, you know what, it's okay. It's all right. I know you're angry and you have a right to be. So, you know, we'll do what we can for you.
Yeah.
I mean, I've had moments where I was in France on a the Martin Chandon Fellowship, and I had this really strong dream about these particular shells. And I contacted a friend of mine who was working in Cambridge at the time and said, and that was the days of fax, and I said, have you seen any shells? You know, I just really want to sort of do something with this. And she said, funny you should say that, I'm looking at one right now. And I find that even day before yesterday, I contacted somebody at the Anthropology Museum, Jane Wilcock, asking about a particular object that I want to reference. And she said, yes, I'm here at the moment with them. And it's, I think sometimes these things unearth themselves or reveal themselves at the right time when you're ready to work with them, if they're meant to be. And, of course, you've got to check with community, all of that as well. But I think it's sometimes that, whether it's serendipity or whether it's timing or whatever, I think that these things happen to connect, and they're for a good purpose.
Definitely, definitely. We are going to head to a song break right now, and the song we're going to head to is I Want to Be Free by Roger Knox. My guest in the studio this morning is Tina and Judy. They are a part of a deadly exhibition that is opening tomorrow, which is called Defining Empire. You are listening to Let's Talk here on 98.9 FM.
There's no joy in my heart, only sorrow. And I'm sad as a man can be. I see it alone in the darkness of my lonely room. And this room is a prison to me. I look at my window. What do I see? I see a bird tree. I wanna be free, free, free. I wanna be free, like a bird in a tree.
Wanna be free.
Oh, what good are my eyes? They can't see you. And my arms, they can't hold you so tight. I have two lips that are yearning, but they're no good to me. 'Cause I know I can't kiss you tonight. I look at my window. What do I see? I see a bird.
Let's talk.
And you're back on 98.9 FM. And that was Roger Knox with I Wanna Be Free. Deadly song that is, especially with the discussion that we're having with Tina and Judy, who are... Tina is the curator and Judy is the one of 30 artists, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander artists, for the exhibition Defining Empire. Before the break, we were yarning a bit about, you know, years going overseas, England, and, you know, hearing stories about, you know, remains all over the world. How common is it to find Aboriginal remains all over the world, like, off the top of your head, like, yeah, like...
I'm not really sure. I just remember going to a conference in the early 90s down in Canberra in which there was a booklet circulating around which showed all the different overseas museums and where Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander collections were. And that's why, as I said, that was early days. I was using fax then. And so I ended up faxing all of these places, like the Horniman Museum, Science Museum, Cambridge, you know, Museum of Man, which is a British museum, Oxford Museum or whatever, just saying, well, I'm an artist, am I? Can I come in and have a look at the work? And most people were pretty good about it. There were a few people who were, I remember one woman, I described her as like a rabid dog. It was like, don't get too close, don't touch that, that sort of thing. But sometimes, and it's called, what's it called, vigilating, you know, sort of, you know, I was being vigilated under vigilance. And I think that it's an interesting thing. I think there's a lot more trust now as people start to get to know the process of artists. And I think that once curators and the keepers, and that's another film work that I've sort of made, has been looking at the process of what it's like for somebody who's never been to one of these places to go into the bowels of the British Museum to, when I say the bowels, it's not really, it's a storage place, to see these objects and what it's like for the objects, what it's like for people in photographs, you know, all of that sort of thing. And it's not all bad because, you know, the people who are working there are mostly really, really valuable, you know, sort of sources of information. They really... look after the objects and cultural material and care for them. But it's just that process of being sort of like an institutionalised care. It's all of that sort of thing, and it just brings up a lot of questions. So that's the sort of thing I think that artists should be doing, is just bringing up the questions so that we all ask it and we keep the conversation alive.
Absolutely. As Judy was talking, I was also thinking about, it's not just, you know, as a worker in museums, it's also the records and the archives that go along with those collections and ancestors that are really, really important and that can inform so much of how they arrived and how they're looked after. And, you know, words in themselves are so powerful in these places where, you know, policies regulate who and how people can access these collections. But it's those archives and the material that, whether it's at the museums or galleries or in archives themselves, that connect up the dots along the way as to, you know, this person collected this material and then just decided to gift it to someone or to an institution. So, you know, it's that whole gamut of, you know, gallery, libraries, archives and museums that... that our people should be able to access and feel comfortable accessing, and so that's where hopefully with more with artists doing more works with collections and archives, giving confidence to communities and individuals that it's okay, you know, and with more Indigenous people working in these areas as well, you know, we just want to be able to open up access to everybody. So, yeah, when you do go overseas, you know, those of us who have been working in this area for a long time, you know, you kind of hope you're paving the way for others to come through and feel comfortable and, you know, really find out real histories about, you know, individual objects and materials and that.
And Marcy Langton talks about how Queensland Aboriginal people are among the most documented Indigenous people in the world. So it's not just the objects, it's also us. But I think that it's empowering for everyone now and like the younger generation to realise this is all records that they can access and learn more about and then sort of send it out, you know, to their children and, you know, contemporaries.
Yeah. And also a lot of the Queensland mobs, I guess, you know, I don't want to say worse off than any other, you know, mob around the country, but, you know, historians record, I think it was about like 60,000 Aboriginal people within Queensland in the frontier wars times, you know, were, you know, slaughtered.
Mm. And what was documented.
Yeah, that's right. Well, that's what began it. But like we've been, you know, yarning a bit about, you know, the works you mob have been doing and, you know, you're travelling and stuff. We'll get on to the exhibition. Defining Empire, what a name. Did you just come up with it, or was that sort of a name that was given to you and you just rambled?
No, that definitely kind of jumped out to me as I was doing a lot of historical research to, you know, not only the sort of art practice of each of the artists and the sorts of areas that they're, you know, looking at or, you know, because it's looking at the contemporary works by these artists and looking at the historical records, the one thing that kept jumping out to me, which I loved and I thought was great, was the annoyance by the colonisers that the Aboriginal people were constantly defying them. Mm. You know, it was this defiance which was annoying the hell out of them, which unfortunately also, you know, created, you know, horrible practices because, you know, our mob were standing up to these invaders and they just did not know how to
react.
So they just went and, you know, as you said, with the frontier, you know, that as it swept across the country, it was just absolutely horrifying and very violent. But it was that strength and that resilience and that defiance that I read throughout a lot of the records of our ancestors and warriors that I just thought, you know what, and we're still doing that today. We have warriors today.
Yeah.
And our artists who are, as far as I'm concerned, you know, brilliant warriors in getting those histories and stories out. And so, of course, empire, most people understand that's the British Empire. And they were, you know, really the first that had that, you know, major impact on our people. And so it was defying empire was what came up in the end.
Mm. And this, there's about 30 different Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander artists from all over the country. Mm. How, like, were you involved in picking the process of the artist, or?
Yeah, the final 30 came down to my decision.
From
over 60.
Yeah.
And it was really, really hard. I certainly had my key artists who I really really wanted to represent.
Yeah.
And of course, as you mentioned, there's emerging mid-career and established artists. So, you know, when it comes to emerging artists, there's just an incredible, incredible array of emerging and mid-career artists who, you know, you think, what impact will this sort of a show have on them and their career and an opportunity for them to, you know, showcase their works. But also for the established artists like Judy, you know, looking at what their latest works are and what stories are they telling at this point. And because the show, when it opened last year in 2017, commemorated the 50th anniversary of the 1967 referendum, which, of course, was a major pivotal point for Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander people and affairs in this country. You know, it was just important to focus on certain artists and their works that they were talking about. So, you know, Judy's works on massacres is just, it's an ongoing project, but it's just so incredibly important to tell. That, of course, you know, I wanted to focus on.
Might have lost a few Facebook friends.
I don't care. I don't really, you know. And you know what, if anything, I think we've gained a lot of, certainly from that first exhibition in Canberra, a lot of people, you know, for me, I always do these exhibitions for our people, first and foremost. And if others, non-Indigenous, international, whoever else, end up engaging and coming on board, then that is a bonus. But for our people, you know, to have that voice and to be empowered in these big, big built white institutions, then I think that's a great thing. So,
I've spoken to a lot of, they've come up and spoken to me about the show and other things, you know, that talk about this. This is non-Indigenous people and they're all incredibly moved. And I think if they are moved emotionally or move to sort of really sort of just change their thinking, they will start discussing that with other people, and that's the main thing. You know, if you can get that conversation changing, that is what is going to lead to change within the community, the wider, whiter community.
Definitely.
And I think in with the show, you know, listening to Judy about that, it's kind of in the same vein as the 96-7 referendum, where for 10 years, you know, our leaders were championing so many of the non-Indigenous communities to come on board and vote yes for this referendum. So, you know, if we can get people on board to then, you know, fight for and support our communities today in the issues that they're, you know, raising and fighting for, then, you know, I think that's a great thing.
And the significance of that as well is it was like 97%. You know, like the voting, like, you know, will there ever be a time anytime soon where it gets to that capacity? Yeah, and like that just shows you how hard working, like those old uncles and aunties was back then.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there's like the name is very, very, you know, significant, defining empire. But then also, the exhibition is going for a while, and it finishes 2020, which is a very significant thing as well.
Yes, yeah, it finishes in Sydney at the Australian National Maritime Museum. Very appropriately in 2020, which of course 2020 is the 250th anniversary of, you know, Cook's Landing, or the 250th anniversary of Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander people experiencing these invaders. Yeah. It was really important and a significant, you know, I suppose, partnering with the National Maritime Museum for that year.
How was that sort of discussion? Like, how did that,
Just, you know, Bo James, who's the curator there at the Maritime Museum, had seen the exhibition in Canberra and, you know, and he really wanted to have that voice present in Sydney in that year.
Oh, okay, cool. That's
and,
awesome.
It just works out really perfectly with the touring side of it. Yeah. And you know what, I would have shuffled everything just so that, you know, it could be there at that time. Yeah. So, you know, along with the other programs that they're doing, I think it's going to have a loud voice in Sydney, which is what we need.
Yes, definitely. Mm. And like we did mention, there are 30 different artists, you know, from emerging, you know, established. How important is it to sort of have that mix of, you know, I guess these sort of three different spaces where artists are in their sort of, you know, artist life? Like, how important is it to sort of, you know, have people like Judy, you know, in this space where there's young emerging artists? Like why is that important to sort of, you know, mentor young kids, you know, or younger artists, or just, you know, emerging artists, whether they're older as well? You know, like, how important is it, well, I guess for yourself, how important is, you know, art and sort of the style that you do in representing our people or representing what has happened? Judy?
Oh, me. sorry. Well, on various projects I work on, I often try to work with younger artists, and I have done a lot of teaching and sort of running workshops and things like that. But, for example, on making the Toro sculpture, which is at the front of Quaggoma, I just happened to be chatting with Lisa Carmichael, who's a young... she was emerging. I would say that she's, you know, sort of more than emerging now. Mm. And she worked on that project with me. There's been other artists. I think it's always good to bring people in, as you do within the community, to work with them. Mm. And to... Yesterday was, you know, talking to design track students at Quaggoma, for example, and there's a whole group of people there supporting those students who are doing an art project or, you know, sort of studies from all over the state and down at Coffs Harbour. Mm. And I think that both for the galleries, the artists, everybody who can work with them, that's just a natural progression of something that you would do. You know, you don't want to just stay with the old, you know, sort of die-hard, you know, sort of artists, because otherwise nothing will keep going. And so the conversation needs to be more lively, and it's very empowering to... younger or emerging artists to be in these shows, because suddenly it becomes part of their CV, it becomes part of the dialogue, and then they will get picked up for other exhibitions, and it means that they can progress their careers as well.
Mm.
But it also, I mean, just the feedback that I've received by individual artists, it's like, oh, my gosh, I can't believe I'm in a show with one of my idols, you know, and just meeting them, and they're just fantastic, and it's just so great. So it's that, it's an opportunity for that networking and connections being made. And, you know, it was interesting. I had a Torres Strait artist, you know, mentioned they'd met one of the old aunties from Yirrkala. And he said, we couldn't speak each other's languages, but that didn't matter. The art connected us, and he was inspired to go on and look at different areas. Mm-hmm. And when you see what other artists are actually producing and the stories that they're telling and how and why they're doing it, mm-hmm. you know, it's I think it's a kind of a multiple way connections that the artists have. And if we as an institution have an opportunity to make those connections for community out there, mm-hmm. I think it's great. But it's not just for artists, it's also for arts workers as well. So we've had a number that have come through working on this project or even in organisations, you know, wherever it travels and that, you know, to connect up with, you know, potential. I mean, I'm always advocating for, you know, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people to work in, mm-hmm. you know, museums and galleries and archives as such, you know, to strengthen our voices. And if they can connect with artists, if they can, you know, connect with organisations, then that's great. So, you know, it was a real a wonderful opportunity to be able to connect everybody up together. And I just thought that, you know, the people, the artists selected were just leaders. Well, they still are leaders, not only when it opened last year, but, you know, real leaders in their communities today.
And, whereabouts are these artists from? Like, you're bringing them in from all over the country?
Yeah, they're from all over the country, but they, you know, they live all over the country as well. So we've got, you know, artists from all states and territories. So, you know, do you want me to read out the list very quickly?
Yeah. It would be good. Like, just give it, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be really good. Like, Tony Albert from Queensland, Brooke Andrew from New South Wales, Sebastian Arrow, who's an emerging pearl shell carver from Western Australia, Northern Western Australia. So Daniel Boyd, who's from Queensland but lives in Sydney, Marie Clark, Victoria, Megan Cope from Queensland, Brenda L. Croft from the Northern Territory, Carla Dickens from New South Wales, Black Douglas, or a.k.a. Adam Hill from New South Wales, Fiona Foley from Queensland, Julie Goff from Tasmania, Lola Greeno, Tasmania, Dale Harding, Queensland, Sandra Hill from Western Australia, Southwest Western Australia, Jonathan Jones, New South Wales, Ray Ken from Armada in South Australia, remote community there, Yvonne Coolmatry from South Australia, Nongana Marawili from Northern Territory, Archie Moore from Queensland, Laurie Nona from the Torres Straits, Badu Island, Rusty Peters from Warman Arts in Western Australia, Rico Rennie, who's based in Victoria but his people are from New South Wales, Brian Robinson from Queensland, Torres Strait, Ioane Scarce from South Australia but based in Victoria, of course, so Ken Thiday Sr., who's a senior Torres Strait Islander artist, Judy Watson, of course, from Queensland, Vicky West, Tasmania, Jason Wing from New South Wales, Pedro Wanamiri from the Tiwi Islands in the Northern Territory, and Raymond Zada from, he's based in South Australia but from New South Wales. So we've got such a strong representation across the country, not only via the different mediums that are used, the different histories and stories, but just the actual representation is pretty diverse.
And how important is that to bring all those artists together?
I think it's important to have a diverse voice. I mean, unless you are focusing on a particular community or a state or as such, you know, I mean, as a national institution and as a, you know, National Indigenous Art exhibition, it's important to show the diversity that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander art isn't just, you know, what's typically known as bark paintings and central dot paintings. It is incredibly diverse, incredibly contemporary and incredibly powerful. And so having that representation across the country is important, not only for the artists, for the mediums used, but for our histories. For the vision that I had for this exhibition, at least anyway, it was very important to have that cross representation of those diverse histories, which are still interconnected and still very similar. You know, those same experiences of stolen generations, massacres as such, still occurred across the whole of the country, but, you know, hearing it from individuals, artists and communities was really quite powerful.
Yeah, deadly, of course. It would be, and it is as well, you know, bringing so many different stories as well. And also it ties in well with, you know, the theme and also, you know, the date that we're, you know, the exhibition's heading to as well. You know, bringing all these stories together that, you know, have a reason to sort of be involved in that discussion, in that 250-year discussion. Sorry?
I think it's also of its time at the moment. The Tate Modern just had a show, Artist and Empire, and that discussion seems to be going across not just the British Empire but many of those empires and countries around the world where the dialogue is there and it's like massacres or all those sorts of things. Suddenly people want to know about them. Before they were suppressed. Maybe the old people didn't want to talk about them, whatever, and now it is time. It is time to have the discussion.
Yeah, I think Canada had like 150th anniversary of Canada, but also I think they had an anniversary of Captain Cook over the last few years, I think. I think it was,
In America,
In Canada.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. But then, you know, like I think, because where else did he travel? He travelled
Hawaii,
the Pacific,
I noticed that there's a mention on Facebook at the moment of Cook's memorial, a photograph of the actual spot where he was clubbed to death, which a lot of people are like, oh, that's a great memorial. And, you know, let's commemorate that one. So,
It was the 14th of February. It's been good having you on the program this morning, yarning about everything, you know, really, really good insight for our listeners as well, not just on the exhibition, but what yous both have been involved in as well. It's an important thing to have our people understand, you know, the stories behind artists who sort of bring, you know, these deadly artworks as well. There's a really, really good piece as well. It's I think it is Captain Cook, and somebody's put like a balaclava over his head. That's a really, really who done that piece?
That's a work by Jason Wing. It was based off an original work that was called "Australia Was Stolen by Armed Robbery," which caused a lot of controversy when it won a major Indigenous Art Prize. But I think, you know, when you see that, you know, that's one perspective of Cook. You know, and he was just one part of our history. Yeah. I mean, I think works that have had, you know, just as much impact as works like Judy's work, The Names of Places, which is an ongoing, very much a living archive of works where it's documenting massacres through the written records and oral histories. But Judy can talk more about that one for sure.
And then, like that in itself must be sort of a hard task to sort of, like, prepare for, but then also, you know, getting to communities to have those discussions. Like, obviously there's people that are willing to talk about these stories, but then when you unravel and I guess you go through these documents and you read sort of the fine print of how it actually went down.
Yeah. Well, I think that The Names of Places, I mean, that sort of actually was sparked off for me, I mean, by a number of things. I mean, certainly I've known of massacres around the place, not all of them, of course. Nobody will ever know all of them until we keep going and sort of, you know, more research comes up, you know, through documents or through oral histories and also through ground, you know, sort of, you know, surveys, you know, where you can actually do those surveys.
Yeah.
And that's what people are doing now. They're actually doing ground penetration to sort of check on all of this. All of this is ongoing. But also before there was a lot of hearsay, and I certainly grew up with hearsay, but now if you follow the hearsay, then there could be something there, you know, when there's spark, there's fire, that sort of idea. And there's also other maps around. Much research has been done by many people, you know, including Lyndall Ryan is working on one through the University of Newcastle. Fiona Foley's been doing research for a long time. Gary Foley, you know, a whole lot of people in Tasmania, Victoria, all around WA. So it's not just one person, but it's everybody's starting to bring these stories in.
And I guess what is the collective number, you know, if you brought all those massacres, you know, those maps, those researches, like, would there be any that sort of just comes to mind? No?
I think it's unknowable.
Yeah.
Because those statistics keep changing. Mm-hmm. Lyndall might, through her academic research, might have a certain number.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we shared the same researcher in that Jonathan Richards, who's mm-hmm. at the University of Queensland, brought a whole lot of documented evidence, like the Whitefella evidence, to the project, the names of places.
Mm.
So if you go onto the digital map, and this is free for anyone to look at, it's called thenamesofplaces.com.au. You just, you know, look on and click on a site, and then depending upon what Jonathan has got together, you'll find written, handwritten notes or research or files on that. And this is just going to be something ongoing. It's not something anybody's being paid to do. We're just doing it because we're interested. I think with Lyndall, she's got a funding to do that, but I quite like the fact that we're not actually tied into any institution, so we don't answer to anybody except ourselves. Greg Hooper's also on the project. He's done a lot of sound recording for me on the recent Mile Creek Massacre project, which was down at New England Regional Art Museum. And my work in this exhibition is just the, well, as far as I know, it's a work called Pale Slaughter, which is a list of implements that I have found or that were actually ordered to be used in massacres. So there's things like bayonets and, you know, sort of swords and, you know, particular rifles or guns or weapons, etc. I'm sure there would be more, but that's work, one work. And the other one, The Names of Places, is a video.
Mm.
It's like a roll call of discredits. You know, you see it in a movie in the credits.
Yeah.
This is the discredits, you know. And as one of my cousins said, this is my non-Aboriginal side, she said, where wasn't there a massacre in Australia? And really, exactly. we don't know.
I also want to say a big thank you for joining us in the studio this morning. The exhibition opens tomorrow?
Yes.
What time?
Oh, well, on Saturday.
On Saturday,
yes. Yeah, so they're opening hours of 10 a.m., I think.
Okay, and the address?
It's the University of Queensland Art Museum, University Drive is one of the addresses, at least, anyway.
And it's free.
And it's free, deadly. And it is an exhibition that everybody should see in Brisbane, I urge. You know, hopefully, if I can't make it tomorrow night, I'll try and come in through during the day with my partner and our daughter. But big thank you for joining us on the program this morning. You are listening to Let's Talk. My guests on the program this morning is Tina and Judy, curator and artist for the Defining Empire exhibition that is here in Brisbane until November 11th.
Yes.
Big thank you for joining us on the program, and you are listening to Let's Talk here on 98.9 FM.
So strong, follow the sun.